Deadlines, Iran's Constitutional Council says all necessary steps have been taken for protecting the people's rights and having a secure presidential election on Friday. U.S. Democratic and Republican lawmakers are set to introduce a bill seeking to boost Washington's support for Taiwan amid rising tensions with China. And China launches a spacecraft with three astronauts as part of a mission for the construction of the country's first full-fledged space station. Hello and welcome everybody here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is the World News. Our top story for this half hour, the spokesman for Iran's Constitutional Council says the body has taken every necessary step to protect people's rights and conduct a secured electoral process. Abbas Arikat Khodai made the comments in a press conference ahead of Friday's presidential election. He said there will be nearly 67,000 polling stations across the country, stressing that they all would observe coronavirus-related health protocols, including social distancing measures. Khodai said a number of observers, including representatives of candidates, would monitor the voting process. The Constitutional Council spokesman added that the people should not worry about the distribution of ballot papers inside the country or Iranian consulates for those living abroad. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has highlighted the significance of elections in the country prior to Friday's presidential vote. Ayatollah Khamenei called for a huge voter turnout in the presidential election and urged people from all walks of life to participate irrespective of their political affiliations. He said a huge presence of people at the ballot boxes will contribute to removing economic pressure and sanctions on the country. The leader also warned of enemy attempts to undermine people's participation in the election. Ayatollah Khamenei added that Iran's enemies have also made futile attempts to drive a wedge between people and the Islamic establishment. He said American and British media and their mercenaries have also tried to question the veracity of Iran's elections. The leader noted that people, however, have foiled such plans by their huge participation in various elections held in the country. Well, political commentator Alexander Azaragan says the United States is in no position to criticize Iran elections.
I fundamentally disagree with the argument that, if less people vote, that is a vote of no confidence for the Iranian system. Here in the United States, we are chronically more people are voting less. Only in 2020, we had a record of 161 million people who voted in that election. And that's because, we had a lunatic, a malignant narcissist, who was looked upon as dangerous by the establishment within the Republican Party, as well as the Democrats, of course. So, we have no moral credibility to sit around and say the Iranian elections are illegitimate because millions and millions and millions of people don't participate. We got an outrageous and serious voter suppression laws that may be passing in Republican-controlled legislatures around the country because Republicans are 100% inherently racist, at least the Trumpist Republicans. So democracy is being killed at the ballot box here in the U.S., and we really don't have any moral credibility to pick at anybody over their elections.
Well, the Palestinian teenager has succumbed to injuries he sustained in clashes with Israeli forces during an anti-settlement protest in the northern occupied West Bank. On Wednesday, 16-year-old Ahmad Bani Shamsa was shot in the head by Israeli forces in the village of Beita, south of Nablus. He was among the demonstrators who had gathered there to voice anger at the construction of new settler units near the village. Tensions have been running high in the occupied territories for the past few months over Israel's illegal settlement activities and the regime's planned eviction of Palestinian families from their homes in some neighborhoods. Last month's deadly aggression against the besieged Gaza Strip also added to Palestinians' fury. Israeli forces have demolished another Palestinian house in the occupied West Bank. A bulldozer accompanied by Israeli forces razed the structure to the ground in the town of Beit Omar, northwest of Al-Khalil. The demolition comes as the Israeli regime presses ahead with its land grab policy in the occupied territories. The regime usually uses lack of construction permit as a pretext to destroy Palestinian buildings to pave the way for the construction of illegal settlements. All Israeli settlements are illegal under international law. The UN Security Council has so far issued several resolutions condemning Israel's settlement activities in the occupied territories. Zimona Kandil joining us from Ramallah is here with more details on the recent home demolitions being carried out by the Israeli regime. Mona, tell us more about this continued home demolition and land grab policy now that is happening in Beit Omar.
Well, as you have mentioned, this structure was destroyed by the forces in Beit Omar, in Al-Khalil, also known as Hebron South, the occupied West Bank. Despite the fact that the owners of this home have all the documents needed in order from the Israeli court in order to reside in this structure, however, the civil administration, Israeli civil administration and Israeli soldiers decided that they are not allowed to live in this structure. It was built on 170 meters square. It's an agricultural structure where 20 members from this Palestinian family live in this home. And they continue to use it for agricultural in their nearby land. However, where this home is located, it's of course surrounded by a number of Israeli settlements. We are speaking about the settlement of a number of Israeli settlements there, Efrat and Gush Atzion. And 30% of Beit Omar lands were seized by the Israeli forces because a legal settlement of Efrat had been established there. This comes also at a time Israeli forces are usually located and deploying at the entrance of Beit Omar, where an Israeli military checkpoint, as well as a tower, military tower, where the Israeli soldiers do not usually allow Palestinians living there to freely move because they claim they are living very close to the homes and units by the illegal Israeli settlers who are living illegally in the settlement of Efrat. So this time the Israeli claim that Palestinians do not have Israeli issued license in order to construct homes and structures is completely not there, despite having all the documents needed. But the Israeli civil administration decided that the home is located very close to the illegal settlement. That's why it was destroyed, in order maybe in the future, as they usually do, they come and seize the land and annex it to the illegal settlements.
All right, thanks a lot, Mona. Mona Candio joining us from Ramallah. Elsewhere, the U.S. House of Representatives will introduce bipartisan legislation in support of Taiwan next week. The bill, called the Taiwan Peace and Stability Act, is part of the U.S.'s congressional efforts in taking a hard line in dealing with China. The Democratic and Republican leaders of the House Foreign Affairs Subcommittee on Asia say the bill stresses the importance of stability, Taiwan's economy and development, and its participation in international organizations. However, they noted that the legislation does not question Washington's commitment to the One China policy under which Beijing has sovereignty over Taiwan. China has repeatedly warned the U.S. against its interference in Taiwan. The self-ruled island continues to remain a major bone of contention between Beijing and Washington. Geopolitical analyst Brian Berletic says the U.S.-China policies undermine the international law that recognizes the One China policy.
This is another case of the United States officially recognizing international law and, in practice, completely undermining it. Virtually every country on Earth recognizes the One China policy. It is recognized under international law. And everything that we see Washington doing, and more so more recently, undermines that policy and thus undermines international law. Much of what Washington is doing is part of this process of the United States being unable to recognize that it is no longer the so-called international leader.
China has successfully sent a manned mission to space for the construction of its self-developed space station. The spaceship called Shenzhou 12, carrying three astronauts, lifted off from a satellite launch center in northwest China. The astronauts will stay and work on the space station's core module, dubbed Tianhe, for 3 months. It's the first of 11 missions needed to complete China's first full-fledged space station. China started its construction in April with the launch of Tianhe, which is the first and largest of three required modules. Since 2003, China has launched six crewed missions and sent 11 astronauts into space. China is also the second country to put a rover on Mars after the United States. The coronavirus pandemic continues to take its toll on India as the country struggles to contain the disease. India reported more than 67,000 new infections over the past 24 hours, bringing the total cases to 29.7 million. Overall deaths hover around 382,000. The new daily infections in India dropped in recent days after a surge in April and May. Daily infections reached their peak of more than 400,000 last month. Strict lockdowns and mass vaccine rollouts have helped contain the surge. The country now has the second largest caseload in the world, the third highest death toll in the world. Well, Turkey says it has administered about 36 million doses of COVID-19 vaccines since it launched a mass vaccination campaign in mid-January. Turkish officials hope to fully lift the pandemic lockdown by July. Rashan Sagam reports from Istanbul.
Turkish health minister said that the harsh phase of the COVID-19 pandemic in Turkey is nearing to an end, adding the daily infection cases have decreased sharply in the past weeks.
Today, I think the acute period of the pandemic is nearing its end, and we are starting to see the light at the end of the tunnel.
Turkey administered 1.2 million doses of coronavirus vaccine in a single day on Tuesday, according to the Turkish health ministry. The number marks a record in Turkey's vaccination campaign. More than 21.7 million people have received their first doses, while over 13.9 million have been fully vaccinated. Turkey eased pandemic restrictions in June, as now restaurants are allowed to welcome customers in certain capacity, and total lockdown is only imposed on Sundays. Turkey's overall case tally is now over 5.34 million, while the nationwide death toll has reached nearly 50,000. To contain the virus, Turkey currently has a nightly curfew from 10 p.m. to 5 a.m. from Monday to Saturday, and a full lockdown on Sundays. With its fast vaccination campaign, Turkey is going to tackle the pandemic by the end of this month, with most of the residents and citizens vaccinated, and life can go back to normal again. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Brazilian health officials have recorded almost 3,000 daily COVID-19 fatalities, pushing the virus-stricken country's death toll closer to 500,000. Total confirmed cases in Brazil also surpassed 17.6 million after the health ministry registered more than 95,000 infections in one day. Brazil has witnessed the world's third worst outbreak and remains the second deadliest following the U.S. Meanwhile, the U.S. marked the alarming milestone of 600,000 deaths on Tuesday as vaccination slows in the country. U.S. officials have also so far recorded nearly 33.5 million confirmed cases of COVID-19. Well, Britain has reported more than 9,000 coronavirus cases in the latest 24-hour period. That's the highest daily increase since February. The total number of coronavirus cases in the country now stands at 4,580,000. The UK also recorded another 9 deaths. The total number of coronavirus-related fatalities in Britain now stands at 128,000. Meanwhile, in Russia, Moscow Mayor Sergei Sobyanin has warned, quote, the coronavirus situation continues to unfold dramatically, ordering mandatory jabs in the city. Despite this, the EU has agreed to lift coronavirus restrictions for U.S. travelers as Western countries are moving toward a return to pre-COVID life. The decision comes ahead of the busy summer holiday season, critical to the economies of many member nations. Well, an Afghan delegation comprising politicians, MPs, and retired diplomats is in Islamabad under what is known as Track 2 diplomacy. This after negotiations between the Afghan government and the Taliban failed to show any sign of progress amid allegations that Islamabad is supporting the militant group Javed Rana. Has more from Islamabad.
The U.S. troops are fast withdrawing from Afghanistan under a peace deal American had with the Taliban 2 years ago. On the other hand, the Taliban, the militant group who already control nearly 75% territory, is now sieging and capturing districts and regions around the capital city. The Afghan government blames neighboring Pakistan for supporting Taliban's ongoing rapid territorial gains, an allegation Pakistan denies. With new law in the bilateral ties between Afghanistan and Pakistan, influential former diplomats, think tanks, and politicians from the both sides held meeting in Islamabad. The objective behind this gathering, better known as Track 2 diplomacy, is to bring down the tension between two countries and help Kabul to find out a peaceful solution. Negotiations between the Taliban and Ashraf Ghani government have resumed in Doha with no progress in sight. The Taliban want setting up their brand of an Islamic government, while Ashraf Ghani is not willing to accept an interim setup to replace him. The U.S. fears the Taliban could possibly overrun the capital Kabul if President Ashraf Ghani does not strike a peace deal with them. The U.S. has made it clear that Pentagon would not carry out airstrikes from its aircraft carriers outside Afghanistan to prevent Taliban's possible takeover of capital Kabul. In a recent interview with a German newspaper, Afghan President Ashraf Ghani said he knows his death is just one bullet away. Analysts believe that his remarks shows on how he perceives the threat of Taliban's violent takeover of capital Kabul after the U.S. lost war and left his government onto the mercy of warring Taliban. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of the World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
The 13th presidential election. Iran's 13th presidential election is going to be held on Friday, 18th of June. The over four-decade history of the Islamic Republic of Iran shows that people's turnout in elections has had a direct impact on the might of the Islamic system. The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, recently said in this regard, "The result of elections will affect the life of the people and country for years to come, and I hope that the 18th of June election, contrary to what the enemies want, will be a source of dignity and pride for the Islamic Republic of Iran." The leader, referring to the opposition of enemies against elections since the victory of the Islamic Revolution, said, "During the past 42 years, the enemy's agenda has been this way, that before the election, they say people will not participate. Then after the people's participation, they say that the election has been engineered, and about the elected person as president, they say that he has no authority." The leader added, "They try to suggest to the people that elections and the election of president are useless." Election is a symbol of democracy and benefits maximum capacity in society in order to advance all affairs in cultural, political, social, and economic spheres. Thus, there is no doubt in the necessity of elections and its positive effect on society as a whole. However, some persons have raised doubts which mainly have originated in other issues like their own malfeasance and mismanagement. And sometimes enemies fan the flames of discontent to question the system's entirety. Participation in elections and determination of the fate of the country, in addition to the mentioned points, is the political, social, and legal right of every individual. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei said in this regard, "This is a right and an obligation. It is the right of each and every person to raise their opinion. This is their obligation too." The leader added, "Everybody should come and participate in the election. This participation will make the Islamic Republic system strong and will maintain its endurance and longevity and permanence and will cause the country to remain in the shelter of full security." The leader made it clear that election is the greatest symbol of national might, which can cause the formation and continuity of civil society and will provide necessary ground for continuation of progress, growth in the country and the Iranian nation, despite all threats and pressures from the outside. Referring to some concerns about the possibility of a low turnout, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, said, "I believe that the rate of people's participation has nothing to do with this or that name. Rather, people look for a person who has strong managerial skills and is highly efficient for solving the country's problems. And it doesn't matter for people what title this person has or from which faction he's from. Although this issue might matter for political groups, it does not for the ordinary people, the public." The leader reiterated, "It is important that the candidates convince the people that they know the problems faced by society, by ordinary people, that they have good managerial skills, they're prudent, honest, and are able to administer the country. In this way, with God's grace, people will have a massive turnout at the ballot box." Ayatollah Khamenei focused on the main challenge facing the country, saying, "Now the urgent and main issue of the country is the economy, and the candidates should present their programs and solutions to improve the economy and remove the problems faced by ordinary people and convince them that they're able to solve the economic problems facing the nation." fearlessness, Asadullah Badamchian, an activist and member of the Unity Council, said that on the difference of political parties in Iran and non-Islamic systems of government, Badamchian said, a God-oriented party examines who is the best candidate, the most qualified person for the office of president. Thus, a truly Islamic party is after introducing the most qualified person for every responsibility, no matter if he is not a member of the party. Badamchian made it clear that this culture has caused this party to move on in line with the values of the Islamic Revolution since the victory of the Islamic Revolution. Hossein Naqashi, a member of the Unity of Nation Party, says, what is of high importance for the reformist current is trust building in society anew. Trust building should be done for the people and for candidates to introduce their programs and also their manifestos, and persons must be defended strongly. Therefore, this consensus-forming body should first base its plan and priority on trust-building among the reformist current, and put its voting base among the people. This event will not happen unless the people are assured that through programs and manifestos which will be put into action, this will support the people and will create positive change for them in their lives. Persons who are brave enough to counter corruption and discrimination and stand against the groups which are opposed to change. It means persons should be elected who have the courage in their past performance and in their programs, the possibility that this change will take place over the next 4 years. Spokesman for the Guardian Council, Abu Sari Katkhodai, says in this regard, in some years we have had prominent figures, while this year we had a different political climate. Of course, we emphasize on presence of those from a spectrum of backgrounds and political backgrounds, and different political tastes have all been catered for. Campaigns are among the important phases of every election, as they help heat up the people's turnout. It is quite clear that the candidates have entered the scene of the contest with a variety of political and social inclinations and different views on various issues. Thus, they put forward their views and programs and manifestos on different problems, and people will pick the best qualified candidate after examining each and every one of their views and programs.
The debate.
It was a much anticipated meeting between the two nuclear armed powers, and there was a mini breakthrough. The two agreed to send their ambassadors back to their respective countries. But have the U.S. and Russia patched things up and reached any agreements on key issues? After all, what are the key issues anyways? Well, in this edition of the debate, we will look whether there is an appetite from the U.S. or Russia to reach agreements in order to reduce tensions, or will they continue with their volatile relationship fueled in some part by the presence of NATO at Russia's borders? Our guest joining us for this edition of the debate, we have Ian Williams, who's a senior analyst at Foreign Policy and Focus, joining us from New York. We also have George Samueli. He's a senior research fellow at the Global Policy Institute, joining us from Budapest. I'd like to welcome you both. Let me first start with you, if I may, Ian Williams. When it comes to the two leaders, they met, and it appears in some part that the most important breakthrough was them reassigning back their ambassadors. Do you think that was about it?
Well, the fact that they've actually sort of shook hands and agreed to talk is, in diplomatic terms, a step forward. But, you know, we have a disparity. We have different aims and means. Putin can speak for Russia unequivocally. Poor Biden has got a foreign policy establishment filled with lobbies and pressure groups and the Pentagon. He's got diehard anti-Soviets from way back and others all pushing him that he has to do things in a certain way. He's got lobbies saying that, you know, you can't desert our Ukrainian or our Georgian brothers like this. Putin doesn't have to worry about that. What he says pretty much goes. He you know, obviously has to take account of Russian public opinion, but it's not serious in the same way. But the other part is, you know, the geopolitical reality is that Russia is small cheese. I mean, it's got a GDP of about Canada. It's sort of Saudi Arabia with nuclear missiles in many ways. So it's got some loose cash. Its industrial base is ruined. And one of the reasons for the resentment from the people in Moscow is the they listened to the Americans who helped them ruin it. It was the American economic advisors who crashed the Soviet economy with Gorbachev and afterwards, who reduced Russia to a state of a near penury and therefore powerlessness. So now they have a military, they have nuclear weapons, they have a certain degree of spread, and they're trying to assert themselves. So, you know, in that sense, the fact that Biden is coming along to shake hands with them without being condescending and is prepared to talk to them as equals goes quite a long way, I think, because there's a lot of bruised egos in there. If ever you've spoken to the senior people like Sergei Lavrov, the way they were treated in the Bush years and the Clinton years was bruising, really bruising for their egos and for their national pride. So anything that goes to the way of stroking to get them back up again is good. But that doesn't detract from the very real issues. I mean, Putin is no pussycat. He's not really a nice person. You just ask the Ukrainians and the Georgians and the other people, the Moldovans, and the other people with Russian troops on their territories to see that he is not exactly the paragon of virtue and multilateralism that he gets painted by some of his supporters. But then Biden and the U.S. are hardly paragons of international virtue, are they? I mean, on every level. So the idea that they're talking as equals without trying to score points on one level is fine. But at the moment, there's no substantial basis. There's no substantial basis for a war, but then there's no substantial basis for a kiss and make up, because, you know, what are the Russians going to offer? Okay, you can have Ukraine and Georgia back. Right. I'm not going to do that.
Okay, well, those are two extreme stances there, kiss and make up and war. But let's, George Samueli, see at what the U.S. has said, which is what Putin actually said in this press conference in terms of the viewpoint that the U.S. has on Russia, publicly declaring Russia to be an enemy that needs to be contained. So Biden goes into that summit with Putin saying that in the press conference. Do you think that that stance has changed after the summit?
Well, not really. let's remember that for the past 5 years, I mean, particularly during the Trump years, any attempt on the part of the Trump administration to implement what was the platform on which Trump ran in 2016, namely to improve relations with Russia, was absolutely prohibited because the Democratic Party establishment, much of the media, which is in cahoots with the Democratic Party establishment, and to be honest, also much of the Republican Party as well, regarded any attempt to improve relations with Russia as selling out to Putin, selling out to Russia, demonstrating that Trump was a traitor, an agent of Putin's, a puppet of Putin's, a puppy of Putin's, as Biden himself said. So these were accusations made by Biden himself, Obama, and much of the Democratic Party. So Now that Biden is in office, it's suddenly a different story, and apparently it's all about strategic stability, and so it makes sense to talk to Russia. Well, of course it makes sense, and it made sense during the Trump years to talk to Russia. And so that was, it should have been done during the Trump years, and it's right that Biden is doing it now. The point, however, is this. Russia has very legitimate security concerns. It has legitimate security concerns because of NATO expansion. And the NATO expansion has scooped up every single state that had been aligned with the Soviet Union. It has scooped up republics that had been a part of the Soviet Union. NATO in 2008 had promised NATO membership to Ukraine and to Georgia. NATO is clearly still promising continued NATO expansion to take on board all, not just Ukraine and Georgia, but the Central Asian republics. NATO also wants to take on board Belarus in the hope that they, presumably, that they can get rid of Lukashenko in the meantime. NATO, and that means the United States, walked away from the ABM Treaty in 2002. NATO walked away from the INF Treaty. That was 2 years ago. NATO walked away from the Open Skies Treaty. Russia has a legitimate, very serious security concerns. And Putin certainly, the Russians feel very aggrieved about it. This is not to do with egos and making it a sort of a childish psychological exercise. These are serious security concerns. And the reason why there has been a development of a close relationship between Russia and China is that both powers are concerned about Western encroachments and Western aggression. But this bloc, this Russia-China bloc, is a very serious bloc, and it signals a major geopolitical shift during the coming decades against the West and toward this Russia-China bloc.
Mm-hmm. Interesting that you say that. So let's talk about the security concerns Ian Williams, that our guest there, talks about. Obviously, there's lots of reasons that Russia feels that way, and they obviously appear legitimate. But it was very interesting when the U.S. President Joe Biden talked and just touched on a couple phrases that you would think would be very serious, but he kind of just touched on it and just moved on. And that was, in so many words, were there to be an accidental military encounter or an accidental war? When he puts things into that context, does that mean that there is a possibility of something like that happening between the U.S., either directly or indirectly through NATO, with Russia? Is that what he may have been referring to?
Well, yes, the forces are poised on a sort of hot, cold war basis. The NATO forces are sort of testing the Russian defenses. Russian aeroplanes are going out over Scandinavia and the North Sea and testing Western defenses. There's plenty of scope for, miscalculation. The whole thing about Ukraine and Georgia and the Caucasus. There's lots of room for miscalculation. So, you know, there needs to be a stand down. Now, the strategic part of this is that I can't help seeing an analogy that Russia is now in the position that Britain was at the end of World War II. It's the junior party to China. And if it cozies up to China, it has to accept that it's the junior party and it is a junior partner. And it's tying its flag. It hasn't worked out that well for the British, by the way, tying their flag to the Americans. It's got them consumably ruined their economy, weakened their defenses, and alienated them from Europe. Apart from that, it's doing fine. And it's the same craving for great power status that the actual economy and military power doesn't merit, which I think we can see in operation. And I do have to say that this love affair between Trump and Putin, it was so good that it was Trump who walked away from all of those treaties alienating the Russian military establishment. It was Trump who wanted to get out of the ABM and the various international treaties. So, you know, the point about Trump, of course, is he had his own motives, and they weren't geopolitical. I'm fairly sure that there was money involved, there were favors involved. And it wasn't because he was pro-Russian, it's because he was pro-Trump, and he wanted things, and people in Russia were prepared to give them to him, and he was prepared to play up to it. That's been very, very clear. The man is absolutely cynical and apolitical and unpatriotic, I think you can say, if you organize a mob to storm your own capital on the transition. So, you know, let's say the least glorious episode of American relations was under Trump, where he didn't raise any of the issues that might have hurt his personal political and economic power. But he managed to pull out of the treaties, which was equally, which was far more devastating.
Okay. George Samioli, very interesting when the issue of human rights came up. Because the fact that I'm saying that is due to the way that Biden, when he delivered any of the other statements, it seemed like his passion came out when the issue of human rights came up. And he said, and I'm quoting him, made it clear to Putin, we will continue to raise issues of fundamental human rights. We need some basic rules to follow or abide by. And he said that no U.S. president could keep faith with American people if they did not defend democratic values. And, of course, lots of references there made to Navalny, of how important that is for the U.S. Putin had his own things to hit back the U.S. with, like the Black Lives Matter movement, like the insurrection that took place on Capitol Hill. Does the U.S. have even a footing, really, to address Navalny and then say these things to Putin when Putin had what he said in return? I mean, who's in the right here?
Well, of course, the United States doesn't have any basis for raising any of those issues. I mean, in the first place, it is a matter of domestic affairs within Russia. There was a trial. Navalny was on trial. It was an embezzlement case. Now, if Biden, if the State Department has evidence that this was a bogus trial and that this was all fraudulent, then present the evidence. Tell us why it is wrong for the court to convict Navalny of embezzlement. But nobody ever does this. I mean, they just simply repeat the thing, oh, that it's a matter of trumped-up charges, because it's just easy to come up with a slogan. But if you are going to say, we have a right to comment on Russia's internal affairs, we have a right to comment on the human rights situation in Russia, because we are signatories of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, then fine. Then everybody gets to have a right to comment on the internal affairs of every other country. And of course, when the Russians and the Chinese bring that up and said, okay, fine, let's invoke the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and then let's bring up, let's say, what happened to the people on January the 6th. They said, well, you've now got 480 cases being brought. Not one case has actually been brought to trial. There are people being held in solitary confinement. They're being denied bail, even though the charges against them are basically misdemeanors. Now, what does the Universal Declaration of Human Rights say about that? Well, it says that everyone has a right to an expeditious trial. In other words, it's a fundamental human right not to have governments just dangling charges against you in perpetuity in order to terrorize, intimidate, and demoralize the public. So, yeah, absolutely. If the United States starts bringing up Navalny or any other human rights issue, Russia and China made clear in Anchorage, they are going to do exactly the same to say, well, what's your human rights situation? Where do you get off lecturing us when you are violating the Universal Declaration of Human Rights?
Okay, on a number of occasions. Okay. I saw you shaking your head there, Ian Williams. Go ahead.
Well, I'd just like to think of comparisons. The Russians were, in fact, inviting Biden to crash down on Black Lives Matter. The fact that Biden is supporting Black Lives Matter is, to me, a plus for him. I'm very dubious about it. His support for human rights does not extend very closely to Palestinian human rights in general, for example. However, I have to say, that if a group of insurgents had stormed the Kremlin and killed the guards on the gate, then
they wouldn't kill the guards. Stop lying. That is not true. That has been established as not true. And please don't put out lies like this.
The footage
is being
shown.
A lie. It has been established that the man died of a stroke. He had two blood clots. He died of a stroke. Please don't lie.
He's attacking the civilian staff in there, who carrying banners asking to hang. They wouldn't have lasted a second with Putin. They'd have been gunned down before they got to the gate, and you know it.
Okay, well, let's move on to another issue because we're quickly running out of time here. And George Samueli, let me turn over to you, and that is the issue of cybersecurity. And it seems like Biden did actually have somewhat of a plan based on what he said about having 16 infrastructure-type approaches towards this cybersecurity. But it was very interesting for Putin to say that number one on the list of countries that actually have cyber attacks emanate from, it's the U.S., then Canada, which was a surprise. I'm sure many maybe didn't know that. And then the UK was there also. Do you think that, how do you view or how do you assess the way that these two talked about cybersecurity?
Well, that's a promising area for mutual cooperation. And again, the Russians have brought this up for many years. And ever since the, even before the 2016, I mean, they said, look, you're accusing us of interfering in your election. Show us your evidence and let's discuss issues of cybersecurity. And I think that does make a lot of sense, that this is a very dangerous area in which, the cyber hacking and the cyber hacking. I mean, hacking is part of espionage, no question. Everybody does it. Russia does it. United States does it. Canada does it. Everybody does it. Cyber attacks with a view to sabotaging strategic institutions, whether it's nuclear power stations, hydroelectric dams and whatever, banks or something that could cause very serious damage to civilians, that's a different issue. And I think that some way of working out a modus vivendi on cybersecurity, I mean, if that happens, I doubt that it will happen, but if it does happen, then it's all to the good.
Okay. Final question goes to you, Ian Williams. You know, when you take a look at the two countries, there are so many areas that they cross paths on that it would warrant, in some respects, their cooperation, which then would probably win over those conflict areas. You could talk about Syria. Perhaps you could talk about Iran in some sense. You could talk about a whole host of other issues here. But it doesn't seem like the U.S. is on that path. It's more confrontational with Russia. And based on what you have seen in this summit, do you think that the U.S. is going to continue that confrontational path with Russia, or will it cherry-pick or pick certain areas that they can cooperate on?
Well, both sides have been confrontational. I mean, the Russians have confronted and tweaked and done things. I've no doubt at all that the Russians are involved in cyber warfare, but so is the U.S. I mean, you just have to ask the Iranians about their centrifuges and who crashed them. The U.S. is practically boasting about it. And so they can hardly complain if somebody does it to them. But of course, this is the big problem in both cases, especially in the U.S. case. You know, how dare you do what I'm doing? Of course the U.S. has interfered in elections in the sense of providing support for democratic groups. I don't believe it's fiddled with the vote in these countries yet. But, for them to raise their hands and say, oh, no, non-interference, and then go interfering in other places all over the world, it is, let's say the least, hypocritical. They're both, it's the pot calling the kettle black, as we say in the old English saying. And, you know, a lot of what they're accusing Russia of is what they're doing. They are the ones pushing up against the Russian border. The Russians are pushing back at the expense of the neighbors, the Ukrainians and the Georgians and the Moldovans and the others. But it's still, there's room for push and shove on both sides. And the real point is that Russia, because of the perestroika and the fall afterwards, suffered a catastrophic loss in power and economic power and military power, and the world has not yet adjusted to it. I don't think the Russians have, and the Americans are unrelenting and carrying on pushing.
Thank you very much for that. Unfortunately, I got to jump in because we're fresh out of time. Sorry, Ian Williams. Thank you. Thank you for that. Ian Williams there, Senior Analyst at Foreign Policy and Focus. Thank you so much for your thoughts. Also, George Samueli, thank you, Senior Research fellow at Global Policy Institute. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Debate. From Mikhail Batavoy, the entire team in the capital of Tehran, it's goodbye.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, who is wise? Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Brothers and sisters, who doesn't like to be called a wise person? Wisdom is a trait that everybody wishes to possess and be known for. Imam Ali alayhi salam was asked to describe a wise man, and he replied, "The wise is one who puts everything in its right place." A lot is said about the meaning and concept of wisdom. But the above definition by Imam Ali alayhi salam says it all so succinctly in one short phrase. A better interpretation would be hard to find, or maybe is impossible. Wisdom is nothing other than putting everything in its right place, giving everyone the place they deserve, showing grief and happiness, friendship and enmity, mildness and harshness, kindness and severity according to the circumstances, adopting correct priorities in worship, work, and healthy recreation. In short, doing the right thing in the right way at the right time is what a wise person does. So, brothers and sisters, we sometimes take our lives very non-seriously, let me say it. You know, we want to become a wise person, but we don't know the recipe of becoming a wise person. We need to get up there. We need to update ourselves. We need to make sure that we are following the teachings of Quran, Prophet, and Ahlul Bayt, because they are the source to that ultimate divine wisdom that all of us are expected to achieve. Once we achieve that divine wisdom, we are going to start making the right choices in our life. And because of that, our own life is going to be at ease. Welcome back, dear listeners. Today we are talking about who is wise. Since Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, as the most wise, knows in an absolute way the place of everything, He sent prophets and revealed books to human beings in order to teach them the proper place of things. In the case of Prophet Adam, Hazrat Adam alayhi salam, the Quran mentions that God taught Adam the names of all things for him to be vicegerent or the Khalifa on earth. This is in Surah Al-Baqarah, chapter 2, verse 31. The Quran also explains that wisdom is given to all the prophets, together with the book of Allah, in order for them to guide people to the true path of goodness. This is in line with another verse in Quran that pronounces, whoever is given wisdom, he is indeed being given an abundance of goodness. This is chapter 2, verse number 269. So from that, it is very clear that we have to achieve the level where we can become a wise person. This wisdom is a necessity. It's not something good to have, you know. And we're going to discuss how wisdom is different from just acquiring bookish knowledge. This is another misconception sometimes, you know, when we talk about wisdom, people think that, you know, it's just going through a bunch of books and, you know, becoming an expert of those books and those subjects. No, wisdom is something deeper than that. It is something that has something to do with knowledge, but it's definitely something different than just being knowledgeable or having a lot of information. So, inshallah, let's pray to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that we can walk this path of becoming wise. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parsetoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
World with reporters.
Palestinians in the Gaza Strip held demonstrations in several parts of the enclave in response to the return of the controversial flag march in East Jerusalem al-Quds. The protesters said the move is aimed at provoking Palestinians' anger. They burnt Israeli flags and vowed to defend Jerusalem al-Quds with all means.
The Israeli regime is responsible for the consequences of its crimes in Jerusalem al-Quds. It's provoking us by holding this flag march. Palestinian resistance in all parts of Palestine announces its readiness to respond to the violations in Al-Aqsa Mosque. The international community should stop such violations.
The extremist flag march passed through the old city's Damascus Gate and entered the Muslim Quarter. This amid a fragile ceasefire in the Gaza Strip following the recent Israeli aggression that claimed nearly 250 Palestinian lives. The flag march caused Hamas to warn that the tensions in the Gaza Strip will break out again after Israel's 11-day escalation on the enclave.
Our Palestinian people are all united in defending Jerusalem al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque. Our message is clear that we will not allow Israel to impose its plans of stealing our land and holy places. We will sacrifice everything for Palestine, and the resistance is ready to fight back. We do not trust any Israeli ceasefire, and we are committed to it as long as Israel keeps it.
Palestinian resistance in Gaza announced its readiness for any conflict against the Israeli regime in response to the violations against Palestinians in Jerusalem al-Quds.
Any Palestinian would feel angry for what is happening in Jerusalem al-Quds and the Israeli violations of our rights. We are all united in facing this occupation. We are supporting the resistance and we are proud of its achievements in defending us. We will not give up Al-Quds and our holy places, and the Israeli plans there will fail because we are the true owners of the land.
The controversial flag march in Jerusalem al-Quds risks reigniting tensions with Palestinians, both in the occupied territories and the Gaza Strip. Hamas has warned that the march will trigger a new